This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Daryl Chutka, a general internist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. The lung is one of the most common organs transplanted, trailing transplants of kidney, liver, and heart, with over 2,600 performed in 2022 across the nation. Lung transplantation may involve transplanting either one or both lungs, and occasionally may be performed together with a heart transplant. Although some patients with a lung transplant have lived more than 10 years, only about half are alive after 5 years. We'll be discussing when to refer a patient for a lung transplant, who's a candidate for lung transplant, and when should we think about this for our patients? How successful is a lung transplant, and what are conditions that would exclude a patient from the procedure? These are all questions I'll be asking our guests, thoracic surgeon Dr. Sahar Sadoughi and Dr. Kelly Pennington from the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care, both from the Mayo Clinic. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Talks. Sahar and Kelly, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having us. Really appreciate the opportunity, especially to discuss our favorite topic, which is lung transplant.
I might have guessed that. Let's talk about the transplant program at Mayo. How long have we been doing lung transplants?
Sure. So here in Mayo Clinic in Rochester, our first lung transplant program began back in 1987. And then we did our first lung, which was a single lung, back in 1990. Our first double lung transplant, which is actually the most common type of lung transplant we do, which is started back in 1993. And now we also do a combined heart-lung transplant for certain indications, and that was started back in 1994. So We're really proud of the history of our lung transplant program. In the more recent years, we've been really working on ramping up our volume. We've hired a lot of new, both surgeons and medical people that are very passionate about lung transplant. We've seen a lot of growth in this area. So there's a lot of energy and excitement in lung transplant right now in Rochester.
Well, the field of transplanting organs has significantly improved with time. What are some of the major milestones that have taken place that have resulted in this improvement?
Yeah, I think really some of the improvements that we've seen in lung transplantation specifically was the advent of calcineurin inhibitors. And so I think really that's what allowed for lung transplant to be successfully performed, you know, starting in the mid-80s. So cyclosporin came out around 1981. And then we've had some advancements in immunosuppression therapy since that time, but really it was the calcineurin inhibitors coming out. I think Dr. Sadoughi probably has some more comments about the surgical advancements, but I think in modern times, we've also really been able to focus on how we bridge patients to successful lung transplant with ECMO and mechanical ventilation, as well as a better understanding of recipient antibodies for donor HLA antigens and how those play a role in graft failure.
Yeah, I agree. You know, obviously the medical advancements in immunosuppression are going to be critical for any transplant success. So certainly that is crucial in lung transplant as well. And then from a surgical standpoint, we've learned a lot about what the lung can handle in terms of how we perform the surgery. Also with how we store the lungs and preserve the lungs has also changed how we transplant. And I think all of those advancements has really allowed us to expand who we can use for donors, how long the lungs can be outside of the body. And technology in evaluating lungs outside of the body has also helped us.
So how successful is a lung transplant? How long are people living once they receive their new lung?
That's a good question. I think probably the best way that we measure lung transplant success, although we can do it in a lot of different ways, probably the most black and white is survival. Median graft survival following lung transplant, which most often translates into life expectancy, is 6.7 years. And that has improved in recent years, I think, because we've gotten better at managing immunosuppression and the toxicities that are associated with immunosuppression. The first year following transplant is usually pretty complicated for patients as they're healing from a major surgery and from being very ill prior to their transplant. But 1 year survival is actually pretty high nationally for lung transplant recipients, you know, somewhere between that 85 to 95% mark, depending on the institution specifically.
I just echo everything that Kelly said. The lung is an interesting organ, and we're dealing with rejection in maybe a different way than some of the other organs. And so when you look across organ specialties, they have very unique challenges. And I think that's why sometimes the lung, the survival might be a little bit shorter than some of the other organs. Our patients are also very, very sick coming in. You know, they can't breathe. A lot of times there's multi-organ issues going on. So a lot of those things will affect survival. But seeing these patients, especially in right after transplant, and seeing that significant difference of what's happened to their body after transplant is pretty remarkable. And it's still, you know, as a surgeon in this area, it gives me a lot of energy and keeps me going.
And I guess another way to measure success is the improved quality of life, which I'm sure is dramatic right. for many patients.
Correct. It is. We have this video that's on YouTube of one of our patients, the first time that she was getting extubated after a lung transplant. And I think that that video is extremely powerful. It basically, she's never been able to take this deep breath, and you actually see her take her first deep breath and how like shocked she is about how that feels. It's pretty indescribable.
Well, what's the most common reason or common reasons the transplant fails, both in the short term and then later on?
So short-term failures, what we look at is something called primary graft dysfunction. So as you can imagine, we have an organ that's been taken out of somebody else. All the blood has been flushed out of it, and then it's been put on basically in a cooled solution for an extended period of time. And then we put it back in the body, and then we suddenly flush warm blood back into the lungs. And you can get an inflammatory response and basically primary graft dysfunction, where the lung just takes some, I always tell the patients, your lungs might take a little bit of time to wake up. They're not functioning perfectly as soon as the blood comes back in there, and it just takes a bit of time. So in the short term, it's just the body getting used to a new organ, new blood going through it that can affect its function acutely. Long term, Kelly probably can talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, within the first year post-transplant, our patients really struggle with infections, and that is probably the biggest threat to their survival within the first year. Some of those can be, you know, common infections that you and I would get, like upper respiratory infections can have devastating consequences for our patients. Other infections are more indolent, so things that are, you know, common in the environment or ubiquitous in the environment, like molds or non-tuberculous mycobacterium, can really seize the opportunity of an incomplete immune system in our patients and cause devastating consequences and graft failure. Once we get out of the first year post-transplant, opportunistic infections and the consequences of infections do tend to go down a bit. And what our patients are most threatened by is something that we call chronic lung allograft dysfunction. I think the simplest way to sort of describe chronic lung allograft dysfunction is that it's untreatable chronic rejection that usually manifests as a form of respiratory failure. There are multiple different phenotypes of this chronic lung allograft dysfunction that we call CLAD for short. But by year 5 post-transplant, about 50% of lung transplant patients will have some form of CLAD. And that really is the long-term survival threat to lung transplant recipients.
Okay. So we have a patient who would benefit from a heart, from a lung transplant. What other criteria or what criteria do they need to meet in terms of their general health for them to be a candidate?
Yeah, so we do a very extensive review of every patient, basically from head to toe. But we're looking at how well this patient can undergo the surgery, of course. And then we look at how well we think they will do post-transplant, or you know, we want to make sure these patients can handle a transplant long-term. So we're looking at all the organs function. We're also very diligent about making sure that they've had their health maintenance screening. So, you know, breast cancer screening, colon screening, all of the normal screenings that we would recommend. We make sure that they're up to date on that, on vaccinations, all the basic health things, their teeth health, everything basically gets looked at from head to toe to make sure that they could handle transplant. In general, a quote unquote ideal lung transplant candidate would be somebody who has single organ failures. Organ failure of the lung. Certainly, we've transplanted people that have multi-organ issues like a kidney, a heart, liver, but they have to meet additional criteria for that. Kelly, if you want to add anything there.
Yeah, I mean, I think exactly what Sahar just said, we're looking for people who are usually in generally pretty good health. I think the advice I would give to a primary care physician seeing a patient is if you could look at your patient and say, goodness, I'm worried that they may not live for the next 2 or 4 years because of their respiratory disease. But if it wasn't for their respiratory disease, this patient would be pretty successful. That's the ideal person that we're looking for as a lung transplant recipient.
So what criteria might exclude somebody from having a lung transplant?
Certainly malignancy within 2 years is a general statement. I think we're trying to push the boundaries on that a little bit, but in general, malignancy is one. Patients that are having multi-organ failure, you know, that we don't think would be candidates for transplant of those organs as well, would be also an exclusion. We also look at sort of overall ability of the patients, like how far are they able to walk on their own, or, you know, how their overall health that way as well, that would preclude them from surgery. Another really important aspect is their social situation. We focus a lot on the patient, but really what makes successful is their support system. And so having a really good support system in place is critical for success of a transplant patient. Along with that is sort of their social habits. So patients that are smokers are going to be excluded. Drug use, that would be an exclusion. So we want people who can protect that organ long-term and make sure that they are taking the medicines that they need in order to make that a success.
Okay. So what limits your ability to do more lung transplants? What's the biggest limiting factor?
You know, from my viewpoint is looking at good donors for patients. So there's, of course, we've talked a lot about having good recipients, but then there's also the donor side. So we want to make sure that we're giving patients good lungs. So there's certainly some limitations in that area. Some of the things that we're doing is expanding the donor pool by looking at how people are dying. So traditionally, donors are brain death donors. They have no brainstem function and therefore they can donate their organs. There's a subset of patients who we say are not officially brain dead, but can donate after circulatory death, where there's no meaningful recovery from a brain standpoint, but they're not legally brain dead. We can extubate those patients and allow them to die on their own and then use those organs. So we're really trying to expand the definitions of who can be an organ donor. And that's one way to expand the donor pool.
Okay. What are the more common pulmonary diseases that a patient may have where we should probably consider a lung transplant?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think right now, all across the United States, the most common indication for lung transplant is this category of progressive fibrotic lung diseases. Things that fit into that are, of course, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Some of these chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis patients would fit into that category. For the most part, those patients would be coming to us usually from a pulmonary practice, but certainly could be coming from a general practice, practitioner practice. Are a general practice. Obstructive lung diseases are probably the second most common indication for lung transplant. And what we mean by that are, you know, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or emphysema, and then non-cystic fibrosis, bronchiectasis. You know, while cystic fibrosis used to be a relatively common indication for lung transplant, we've seen in recent years, last 5 to 10 years, that that's had a sharp decline. Really owing to some of the gene-modifying therapies like Trikafta, cystic fibrosis patients just aren't needing lung transplants quite as commonly. Some other indications for lung transplant that you might see are pulmonary arterial hypertension. That's relatively frequent indication for lung transplant. Some of the autoimmune interstitial lung diseases, and then even rarer interstitial lung diseases like lymphangioleiomyomatosis are some other indications. But by and large, most patients fall into one of two categories, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis or COPD.
So often patients with advanced pulmonary disease also have, as a consequence, problems with heart failure. So how often do you transplant both heart and lung together? I know that's happening. Is that very common?
So I wouldn't say it's very common, but it's certainly something that we do. And if we look nationally, you know, it's certainly less than 40 of those done probably a year. I would say Mayo Clinic in Rochester is probably the second highest transplant center for heart and lung right now. And I think we'll see some increases in that with the indications for heart-lung transplant as that evolves. So yes, it is something that we do. It is obviously a big surgery to give somebody both of those organs, but we do it.
You know, I have to admit, I don't think of lung transplantation in my patients, and I probably should, but when should we start thinking about this? When do you want to see these patients who we think might be a good candidate? Early on, advanced disease, what would you say?
We do want to see patients once they have, you know, an established trajectory that they're going to have advanced lung disease that's going to be life limiting for them. I do think it's best for the patient if it seems that transplant is in line with their goals, values, and preferences to at least be seen in the transplant center earlier rather than later, just in case there's modifiable risk factors that we can work on to help prepare them to have even more success with a lung transplant. Definitely erring on the side of too late is not beneficial for the transplant center. It's not beneficial for the patient. There's really no such thing as an emergent transplant. So it's better to see these patients earlier on in their disease process once you've established that this really is progressing to end-stage lung disease and that transplant is in line with their patient's values and wishes. Then I think referring them to a transplant center is the right thing to do.
You earlier mentioned organ availability. How long do patients typically need to wait for a lung transplant?
There's multiple factors that are involved in how long somebody would wait. One is their blood type. Two is how sick they are. We give each patient basically a score that's done nationally, not by us, but just we put in their facts and then a score comes out. And that kind of determines their urgency on the wait list. So there's a lot of variability on how long somebody would wait. For example, we have some patients that are actually currently in the hospital who are on ECMO support. Those patients are going to have a very high score and they tend to get transplanted quite quickly. And when we say quickly, we mean within days of going on ECMO support. Mm-hmm. Somebody who is, let's say, at home, who's overall relatively stable, you could see up to a few months of waiting for a transplant. The goal for that is really for transplant programs to address the sickest patients first. So that's why the system has been created that way.
And does each institution that performs lung transplants have their own waiting list, or is there any type of a national registry for this?
So each institution has their own waiting list because those patients go through an evaluation by that institution. And you'll see that some institutions might not think that somebody's a transplant candidate and they get evaluated somewhere else and then that institution does. So each place has their own list.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the success of lung transplantation. How are patients' lives changed by receiving a new set of lungs?
Most patients who have a lung transplant are able to come off of oxygen following their transplant. You know, that first year is really about healing from a major surgery and from being sick and from going into lung transplant. But after that first year, most of our patients are able to do the things that they want to do, whatever they find to be their new normal. If they weren't marathon runners before, they're not going to be marathon runners after a lung transplant. But in terms of exercise limitations, most of our patients don't have exercise limitations. There are some things that they have to, you know, I think watch for post-transplant. And most of those are really in regards to infection risks. So we definitely don't want our patients to be around others who have upper respiratory infections or in crowded places just because of the risk of viral transmission. And then because of some of those organisms that lay dormant in the soil or on surfaces, we want our patients to wear a mask if they're out gardening or digging in the dirt or soil. So those are their limitations. But for the most part, patients can have a pretty normal life following their lung transplant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you see anything in the future that gets you excited about the success of lung transplantation?
Definitely. There's a lot of excitement in lung transplant right now. You know, I think like we had discussed, for good or for bad, lung transplant right now has some work to do on long-term survival. So I think, you know, from a research standpoint, there's a lot of focus on that to help our patients not develop CLAD, like Kelly had mentioned, so that we can see longer term survival. From my standpoint, in terms of donors and lung preservation of how we store the organs. There's a lot of work being done in that area. Recently, there's been some research looking at the temperature at which organs are stored for lungs specifically. And we're participating in a multi-center clinical trial to look at a little bit of a warmer temperature to store the lungs because we believe it helps the mitochondria function and you can keep the lungs outside of the body for longer periods of time. There's a lot of advantages to that. One is that we could go even further to obtain organs. And the second is thinking about when is the best time to transplant in the day. You know, a lot of times we end up doing transplants in the middle of the night. And if we are able to preserve the organs maybe a little bit longer, maybe we can shift when we're doing surgery to make it even safer for our patients. So there's a lot of excitement in what's going to happen in lung transplant.
Well, Sahar, the fact that you are representing the surgical side of things and Kelly, you're representing the medical side of things, it's very obvious this is a team effort in helping our patients who need lungs, receive the lungs, and then the postoperative care.
Yes. I mean, and that's, I mean, part of the reason I think, I mean, me personally, I really enjoy transplant in general. It's definitely a team sport. And, you know, Kelly and I have a wonderful relationship. And that's, I think, reflected in the success of our patients long term. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you've given us some fascinating information about lung transplantation. Can you summarize our discussion maybe with two or three key points?
Yeah, I think really the key point here is that lung transplant is a treatment that can be used to improve quantity and quality of life in your patients with end-stage lung disease that really don't have any other treatment options. And when you're thinking about your transplant candidates, what we're looking for are patients who are relatively healthy with the exception of their lung disease. And really getting them plugged into a transplant center sooner rather than later is to the benefit of both your patient as well as to the transplant team.
I echo everything that Kelly said. I think here in Rochester, we're really focused on continuing to expand our lung transplant program and really have wonderful relationships within our program. So we'd be happy to either provide more information or see some of these patients here in Rochester.
Okay. We've been discussing when to refer a patient for lung transplant with Dr. Sahar Siddiqui from the Division of Thoracic Surgery and Dr. Kelly Pennington from the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care, both from the Mayo Clinic. Sahar and Kelly, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us today. It was a very fascinating discussion.
Thank you so much.
Yes, this was fantastic.
You can now listen to several hundred different medical topics developed for primary care providers on Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts. Find them at ce.mayo.edu or your favorite podcasting app. If you've enjoyed Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts, please follow us. We're honored to have you as a listener and hope you tune in again next week. Stay well.